Millions of people who are being subjugated right now by the Chinese government.
The U.S. Congress is trying to do something about it. This is Thursday, September 24th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, indications that North Korea is readying some new weapons to show off. Who has a tougher time dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, men or women? You'll hear more about that. A UN official says the approaching Myanmar election will be neither free or fair. It is all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. The bill aims to ensure that goods made in China's Xinjiang region and imported into the United States are not made with forced labor. Republicans and Democrats alike supported the bill and took to the House floor to criticize China's human rights record. Joaquin Castro was a Democratic congressman from Texas.
This is an issue of human rights. Millions of people who are being subjugated right now by the Chinese government. And despite international condemnation, atrocities continue in Xinjiang, and China shows no signs of changing course, including recently releasing a white paper defending these quote-unquote vocational training centers.
Republican Congressman Michael McCaul said the time to take action was now.
The world has stood by idly as the Chinese Communist Party rounded up more than a million, probably a lot more than that, ethnic minorities into concentration camps where they are tortured, brainwashed, and forced into labor. This is all part of a deliberate program by the CCP to wipe out their ethnic identity, their religion, their culture, anything that might compete with the Communist Party for their loyalties and affection.
The vote total was 406-3 in favor of the legislation. If enacted into law, the U.S. passed measure could force companies to avoid a region that produces 80% of the cotton in China, one of the world's top producers of the fiber, as well as tomatoes and manufactured goods. China lashed out at the passage of the bill. Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said the bill maliciously slandered the human rights situation in Xinjiang and sought to curb development and progress in the region while stirring up ethnic divisions and interfering in China's internal affairs. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. Pakistan begins Phase 3 trial of Chinese COVID-19 vaccine. Australia relaxes its internal COVID-19 border restrictions as infections fall. The U.S. government drug agency considers stricter new guidelines on approval for COVID-19 vaccines. India's coronavirus infections surged again Wednesday, a day after falling to their lowest figure in almost a month. Malaysia opposition leader Anwar claims a formidable majority to form a new government. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. North Korea is preparing to hold a major military parade next month. Some analysts expect Pyongyang may unveil major new weapons. VOA's Bill Gallo has the latest indications about what those weapons might be.
October 10th is a major holiday in North Korea. It's the 75th anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party. And North Korea is apparently planning a big parade. Commercial satellite photos suggest the North has been rehearsing for weeks at a parade training facility outside the capital. On Tuesday, the website 38 North said part of those preparations appear to involve a missile-related vehicle. The organization does not know for sure what the vehicle is, but says it appears to be large enough to fit an intercontinental ballistic missile, meaning it could be an ICBM mobile launcher. Some analysts predict North Korea may unveil a new solid-fuel ICBM at the parade. Others say Pyongyang could soon showcase a submarine-launched ballistic missile. Either would add an unpredictable new component to North Korea's arsenal. Solid fuel missiles are easier to transport and take less time to prepare for launch. Submarine launch missiles are also mobile and easier to hide. A major display of military power could be seen as a provocation just weeks ahead of the U.S. presidential election. U.S. President Donald Trump says he has no problem with North Korea's short-range launches, but he may object to a bigger move. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Happening now in Asia, organizers of next year's delayed Tokyo Olympics will require COVID-19 testing of foreign athletes upon their arrival in Japan, but may not mandate a two-week quarantine period, that according to draft measures released on Wednesday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The 75th UN General Assembly is breaking new ground by going virtual this year due to the coronavirus. Along with that comes a whole new set of challenges and security risks. Aaron Fedor reports for VOA from New York City.
The 75th session of the annual United Nations General Assembly meeting is underway. But this year, world leaders are not at the UN headquarters in New York. They're staying away because of the coronavirus pandemic and instead delivering speeches via pre-taped video and holding important meetings online.
This is all new to us. The idea of going to a virtual format is relatively new to the United Nations, just like it is to the rest of the world. We've been working on our procedures since March, so they keep getting better as people start to become more familiar with the technology.
But the virtual formats are leaving the UN and other organizations open to cybersecurity threats. The widespread shift to virtual platforms has resulted in a 700% increase in cyber breaches this year alone, experts say. Schools, businesses, and organizations are all vulnerable to so-called Zoom bombing interruptions when hackers break into video conference calls. The door is also open to more dangerous intrusions.
When it comes to organizations like the United Nations, again, you're talking about an organization that many, many different hostile actors stand to benefit by either gaining inside information about what the UN is doing or by altering that information or by changing that agenda.
Ransomware attacks have risen 41% in 2019, according to security firm Emasoft. In such attacks, hackers are able to hold a person or organization's data hostage, demanding ransom money to allow the users to regain access. The U.S. cities Atlanta, Baltimore, and Albany have all been targeted in the past. The UN faces potential ransomware attacks and the threat of hackers breaking into computer systems to steal video files and transcripts.
You may also see people looking to repurpose the video for disinformation reasons. You see people sort of editing video these days and trying to use it for whatever their political agenda is. And sort of given the range of hot button issues that the UN is dealing with, I would also be on the lookout for, you know, maybe a rise and disinformation use as well.
But who would conduct such attacks and why?
So I don't think you're going to see ISIS or Al-Qaeda trying to use the internet to sabotage the UN, but there are a variety of either state sponsors or state sponsored actors or state actors from a variety of different nations that may seek to gain the upper hand or leverage in terms of activities at the UN by either gaining inside knowledge or by altering the course of events through what is going on online.
Brendan Varma says the UN will evaluate how the pandemic and technology develop before deciding whether next year's General Assembly will meet in person or online.
We will make calls based on what works for the United Nations and for the peoples of the world.
But for now, they are working on keeping this year's session safe. Aaron Fedor for VOA News, New York.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
from VOA Asia. Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen has praised the heroic performance of Taiwan's Air Force pilots who have been intercepting Chinese jets that approach the island as the armed forces held drills to simulate repulsing an attack. All of the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Women in the developing world continue to have an especially difficult time dealing with COVID-19. Even though statistically more men than women have died from the disease, this is due to several factors, including their traditional roles and their physical makeup and vulnerabilities in what is still mostly a male-dominated world. To find out more about women and COVID-19, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Papp, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, an international non-government organization that promotes equality and well-being for women and girls. Ms. Papp began by talking about women as the go-to unpaid caregivers during COVID.
Unpaid care is the care that a woman does when she's caring for her children at home, when she's cooking, when she's cleaning, when she's collecting water. Globally, before COVID, women are 3 times more likely to do unpaid care than men. But with COVID, that number has gone up because you have more family members to care for. And those women are needing to be able to care for their out-of-school children, but also trying to hold down a job and be able to financially support their families. You also have more sickness and illness in families, so women are really getting pressed and strained. Women are also in a more fragile position in that many of them are in the informal economy. And so they do not have the social protection systems that afford them the ability to take sick leave, parental leave, family care leave to be able to care for their relatives. So oftentimes there's more economic fragility and vulnerability that women face as a result of COVID.
And women who make up a majority of the healthcare workforce are at a higher risk also for a very surprising and practical reason.
PPE, personal protective equipment, is a huge part of ensuring that health workers are safe. But the suits are designed for men. They're not designed for women. That wouldn't seem to be that much of an issue. But when you think about the fact that many of those health workers may be having their period at any given time during the month, are they going to be able to take off their suits fast enough to be able to take care of their hygiene needs? Or are they foregoing their PPE because they're not sufficiently or adequately designed to them? Or are they having untenable hygiene situations as a result of that? Those are all considerations that female health workers have to contend with that the average person wouldn't think about.
So many female health workers are foregoing the gowns because they're so difficult to get on and off in order to change the sanitary pads.
That's right. If the PPE is not designed for women and it's not useful to women when they're menstruating, they may be less likely to wear it, which does, in fact, put them at higher risk of contracting COVID.
And I understand that the COVID-19 pandemic has catalyzed what some have called a shadow pandemic in the form of gender-based violence.
That's right. We've seen shocking increases in gender-based violence as a result of COVID because you have people who are dealing with economic uncertainty and economic stress and all of the mental health components that go along with that economic stress. And they're also stuck with their families and their partners, oftentimes with their children who are out of school. All of that contributes to a heightened degree of tension in the home. And we're seeing rises of gender-based violence in Kenya, in Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and South Africa. The GBV information management system in Mali, for example, showed a 35% increase in gender-based violence from the same month the year before.
And even more disturbing, many women are experiencing gender-based violence at the hands of the police.
Yes. Early on in the crisis, they imposed curfews, but there were reports of women who are coming and going from essential work that they needed to be able to feed their families, and they were getting stopped by the police and reprimanded for being out after curfew, and there were instances of sexual and gender-based violence that the police were perpetrating against these women. The police are the last people who should be perpetrating gender-based violence. It makes it so much more difficult for a woman to have the trust in the system to come forward and to be able to report the violence and for those officials to be held accountable. So it's really alarming, the downstream effects of COVID. The Gates Foundation recently came out with a report that said in 25 weeks, we have lost 25 years of international development progress.
VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Papp, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, an international NGO that promotes equality and well-being for women and girls.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Can the coronavirus survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you're sick or advised to by local authorities. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Now on VOA Asia, a UN official documenting the human rights situation in Myanmar warns the country's national election on November 8th will neither be free nor fair and will not accurately reflect the will of the people. His presentation of a report at the UN Human Rights Council set off protests from Myanmar and its supporters. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Myanmar would not grant the UN Special Rapporteur entry into the country. However, he was able to conduct his investigation remotely. Thomas Andrews said testimony from human rights defenders, members of Myanmar's civil society, and graphic material indicate that even before a single vote is cast, the election will not be credible.
The results of an election cannot accurately reflect the will of the people. When the right to vote is denied because of a person's race, ethnicity, or religion. And I have seen no evidence that the government is willing or prepared to facilitate the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of voting-age Rohingya located in Rakhine State or in refugee camps in Bangladesh.
Andrew said holding an election during a raging armed conflict while combating the coronavirus was immensely challenging. Besides restrictions on movement imposed by the pandemic, he said the government's shutdown of the internet and social media has made it difficult for citizens to get their messages across.
On the other end of this spectrum is the danger that candidates and political parties will choose to use bigotry and hate speech as political weapons. The people of Myanmar know that this poison not only can impact an election, but can ignite violence. There should be no place in elections for these incendiary messages, be they on campaign posters or in the internet.
The UN investigator showed graphic images of what he called poisonous campaign material. That set off dissenting rumbles from Myanmar, Venezuela, China, Belarus, and Cuba. They argued the visual material was manipulative, had not been approved by the council beforehand, and should not be shown. Council President Elizabeth Tichy Fisselberger said all legal requirements had been met.
We received this visual material 2 or 3 days ago. It was shared with the Bureau, who agreed that it could be shown on the condition that the face of the person we have just seen made irrecognizable, which we did. So the Bureau agreed that this material could be shown.
Australia, Japan, and members of the European Union voiced their support for a motion to allow visual, satellite, and other images to be shown. After a roll call vote in favor of the motion passed, the UN investigator was allowed to proceed with his presentation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We continue on VOA Asia. Rescuers are trying to save scores of whales beached in the Australian state of Tasmania. Earlier this week, a pod of 270 pilot whales were found washed ashore. 200 more were discovered a short distance away Wednesday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The stranding of about 470 pilot whales on the west coast of Tasmania is the largest ever recorded in the state's history. 270 animals were found washed up on sandbars Monday, prompting a rescue operation involving wildlife experts, the police, and volunteers. They've managed to return some of the whales into deeper water and coax them back out to sea. It is a challenging task. Pilot whales can grow up to 7 meters long and weigh 3 tons. But dozens of the pod discovered Monday have died, And Australian wildlife experts believe that most of the 200 whales found beached 10 kilometres away Wednesday have not survived. Yet rescue efforts continue. Wildlife biologist Chris Carleon says they're focusing on those animals with a realistic chance of survival.
We're going to basically take the animals with the best chance to start with and the ones that we're able to deal with. So some animals may be simply too big or in an unsuitable location to actually deal with.
The coastline near Macquarie Harbour, near the town of Strawn, Tasmania, is a known whale stranding hotspot. In 2011, about 20 sperm whales were beached there and most died. Experts have yet to understand why the mammals become marooned. There are various scientific suppositions. The whales use echolocation to navigate, and one theory is that the whales may have been drawn in too close to the coast in search of food. Other theories have asserted that the moon's gravitational pull, or perhaps military sonar, could be responsible. The rescue mission in Tasmania could take days. Experts say cool and wet weather will help keep the surviving whales alive, but they concede it is a race against time. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Entrepreneurs in Indian cities are turning their attention to indoor hydroponic farming that uses the technique of soilless cultivation. For one such enterprise, whose launch coincided with India's strict lockdown, the COVID-19 pandemic actually helped grow business, and consumers began to focus increasingly on healthy foods. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
These rows of lettuce, microgreens, and herbs are flourishing in an unlikely space. An enclosed room in a busy New Delhi market, where Himanshu Agarwal and his mother launched their hydroponic venture, 9 growers, 6 months ago. It was not the best of times. One day later, India headed into a stringent lockdown, making them anxious about selling these freshly plucked leaves amid the pandemic. Surprisingly, it worked to their advantage.
Vendors were open to having good produce, especially during lockdown. They were not even getting basic necessities, getting supplied to their doorsteps. And on the contrary, we were going and giving them fresh produce, which is harvested on the same day.
Hydroponic farming is taking root in India as more consumers demand food without pesticides. Grown without soil and fed mineral nutrients through water, the plants flourish in laboratory-like conditions under artificial light that simulates sunlight.
We are creating the best environment that they can find. And so we are giving them everything that they want, temperature, humidity, air quality. We are monitoring everything, all the aspects for them, so that they give the best result.
The appeal of locally grown greens in a germ-free environment has increased as people worry about contracting the coronavirus and focus on healthy foods. In an upmarket Delhi neighborhood, a shop which stocks the salad leaves found that although higher costs of hydroponics discourage some, demand is rising.
COVID ke chakkar mein abhi log greens pe zyada switch ho gaye hain, to immunity level ke liye.
Due to COVID, a lot of people have switched to greens to boost immunity. People have also become very conscious of eating nutritious food, so sale of such produce and hydroponics is increasing.
For Agarwal's mother, who was a housewife, these plants bring a sense of fulfillment.
They're like my kids. When they grow from a seedling into a full plant, I nurture them like my children.
Agarwal's venture in the heart of the city has won a new title for the former corporate employee.
Urban farmer is actually a very good tag, considering it's a new profession, I would say. And we, like, it gives us a sense that we are back to our roots from where we started.
And as he delivers more boxes of freshly plucked greens, he and his mother are optimistic that hydroponics could show the way for urban societies to grow more local produce. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Keith Lane, Doug Bernard, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Please stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.